This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to late 30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and you're in the studio with me, Priya, and with Kate. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Priya. How are we doing?
Ah, we are both. I think we're both. We're getting through.
We're getting through. We are.
We're moving.
Yeah, we're, you know, 2 feet, heartbeat.
That's right. That's yep. Between us. And, you know, sometimes that's just how things are going. I have a question for you, though. I was thinking about this morning. It was a situation that I was facing this morning. Do you eat cereal?
I used to.
Okay. Well, when you used to eat cereal, if you poured too much milk into the cereal, what would you do?
I'd probably try and eat my cereal as quickly as I could so that it didn't get soggy. Mm-hmm. And then eat the yummy milk. Not eat, drink the yummy milk afterwards.
So you would drink the milk.
I would drink the milk. What about you?
No, well, my tactic this morning was to try and drink as much milk as possible out of the bowl by like tilting it towards my face before I ate the cereal, which I think was like probably, I think your tactic is better. Anyway, I can't abide waste. And so
I mean, like, my tactic risks soggy cereal though, which that's not great.
My tactic,
I think yours is better.
Also risks soggy cereal. My tactic risks spilling milk all over the place and making a huge mess. So actually, I think yours is smarter. Anyway, we have much more serious things to cover in today's show. We'll take you through a quick rundown of what we've got on for today. So first up, we are going to hear a conversation from the 3rd of August between Marissa Spassaro of 3CR's Due in Time and Maggie Munn, Gungari advocate and director of First Nations Justice at Human Rights Law Centre, to talk about the rise in First Nations young people being held in detention without a sentence.
Following that, we will speak with Melinda Davis from Swinburne Education Expert to discuss why Victorian teachers are set to strike for the third time this year on Wednesday, the 19th of August. Throughout the discussion, we'll outline how things got here, the compounding pressure on the sector, and where union negotiations are currently at.
And then after that, we'll be joined by my wonderful co-volunteers. I'm not sure what are we? Idil and Ilo from the Center Against Racial Profiling for a conversation about the upcoming launch of The People's Record, a podcast about race policing and public housing in NARM, Melbourne. And I'm really excited for the launch, which is going to be happening on the 8th of August, where The People's Record will be broadcasting daily on 3CR. And also on the 8th, which is this Saturday, the 6th and final episode of the show is going to be recorded live at the Institute for Postcolonial Studies.
Very exciting. Following that, we will speak with Nick Seaton from Parents for Climate, a national parent advocacy organisation working to empower communities to make the climate safer for children. We will speak with Nick about the Parent for Climate's successful push to close the Climate Active program, the adequacy of voluntary climate claims, and new mandatory climate-related financial disclosure requirements that are in place for Australian companies.
And finally, we will be joined by Bill McKenzie, Deputy Chair of the 44 Flats United Layfield Court Residents Committee, to recap yesterday's action where elderly high-rise public housing residents took their petition to resist the demolition of their homes to the Office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos. And a reminder, we did speak with Tom Cooper, who is the chair of the 44 Flats United Inkerman Street Residents Committee last week. So you can head back and listen to that interview at 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast as well to get a better understanding of what the action yesterday was all about. But really excited to hear about how it went. And we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
The electronic intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 8:55 a.m. 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 6th of August. Elderly residents from NARM's public housing high-rises rallied outside the state housing minister's office yesterday, calling on the state government to halt planned demolitions and preserve their homes and communities. Tenants aged between 55 and 100 from four estates presented petitions signed by more than 200 residents. More than 100 residents have declared non-cooperation with the forced displacement process and have signposted their doors with refusals to meet with Homes Victoria about their so-called relocation.
In other news, conditions in Gaza continue to deteriorate 9 months after the October 2025 so-called ceasefire, with reports of repeated Israeli strikes, ongoing forced displacements of Palestinians, severe shortages of medical supplies and fuel, and rising levels of psychological distress. Almost 2 million Palestinians are now confined to around 30% of Gaza, while aid deliveries remain severely restricted and hospitals, including emergency hospitals, run by international organizations, run low on essential medicines.
Also in headlines, police are investigating an assault at Camp Sovereignty in NAM earlier this week, making it the second violent attack at the sacred site of First Nations protest and community gathering within 12 months. Two people arrived at the camp Sunday night, one filming and the other beginning to pull wood out of the fire before they attacked Gunai. Gunjit Mara and Palawa person and fire protector Ash Nimara, who was dragged, put in a headlock and repeatedly hit.
Also in news this week, the independent public inquiry into the federal government's AUKUS nuclear-powered submarine program has received more than 500 submissions and held hearings across three cities. In the submissions, critics have raised concerns about the program's cost, safety, sovereignty issues, and nuclear waste. Opposition intensified last week with protests outside Labor's national conference, calling for the program to be scrapped and for funding to be redirected towards climate action and social services. The inquiry is expected to deliver its final report in late October.
An update on the H5N1 bird flu outbreak. Conservation groups are calling for an urgent national response after H5N1 bird flu was confirmed in the Murray-Darling Basin region, warning the virus could have devastating impacts on internationally significant waterbird populations and wetland ecosystems ahead of the spring breeding season. They are urging the federal government to invest in emergency wetland restoration and expanded monitoring to help protect vulnerable bird species from the spread of the disease.
Finally, in headlines, thousands of people across the country, including more than 2,500 in Victoria, remain at risk of imprisonment over unpaid fines, despite legal and human rights groups calling for the practice to be abolished. The Victorian government recently extended a pause on enforcing these warrants for another 2 months, but has stopped short of ending the practice. Advocacy groups say the threat of jail disproportionately punishes people experiencing poverty and urge state and territory governments to replace punitive enforcement with hardship supports. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 6th of August. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
The People's Record is a podcast that looks at race, policing, and public housing. Over 5 episodes, we speak with residents, lawyers, academics, and activists about how policing has evolved and public housing communities are targeted. Listen to us on 3CR in August.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is just coming up to 7:10 in the morning. And I wanted to remind folks that this week marks a couple of important occasions. It is Homelessness Week this week, and it's also National Missing Persons Week. Now, Homelessness Week runs across this week, and I think one of the most important initiatives that people can make sure they stay across is the work of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, who are going to be launching their new series on 3CR, Tuned In, Locked Out. And they are currently also fundraising to cover their efforts and to ensure that they can keep doing the important work that they do. So to support their work, you can find the fundraiser link by heading to their Instagram, and that is at Homeless Persons Union Vic on Instagram. And yeah, National Missing Persons Week is going across this week. And as some listeners may know through my involvement with the Center Against Racial Profiling, I've been very privileged to be supporting the family of Imabale Manirakiza, a young person who went missing in 2021 and was tragically found deceased. The coronial inquest into his passing is coming up from the 12th to the 16th of October this year, and the family would really appreciate if folks can come along. And we're also fundraising to try and cover the costs, which are very, very expensive, of bringing family members and loved ones over from Perth to be able to attend the inquest. So to find out more about that, you can head to at Justice for Imabale, E-I-M-A-B-L-E, on Instagram, or the Center Against Racial Profiling's Instagram as well. And now, the Productivity Commission's latest Closing the Gap report has showed a rise in First Nations young people held in detention without sentence. Australia continues to fail to make progress on targets to reduce the rates of First Nations children behind bars, while states and territories continue to detain children in remand at increasing rates, in direct contravention of international law. On the 3rd of August, Marissa Sposaro of 3CR's Doin' Time sat down with Maggie Munn, Gungari advocate and director of First Nations Justice at Human Rights Law Centre, to discuss the issue. We're fortunate to be able to air their chat on Thursday breakfast this morning. And in that conversation, Marissa and Maggie touch on a report released by the Victorian Commission on Children and Young People and break down the Northern Territory government's abolishment of key aspects of child placement principles. Remember that you can tune in to Doin' Time every Monday, 4 to 5 p.m. on 3CR.
I'm calling in from the beautiful lands of the Wadawurrung people down in Geelong, but I'm a Gungari person from southwest Queensland, now living down here in Victoria. As you mentioned, the Productivity Commission released their latest report just last week on the progress that governments around the country are making, or largely not making, with respect to closing the gap. And in that report, it showed that a number of the closing the gap targets are, you know, we're not on track to meet any of them. And in a lot of instances, we're actually making negative progress, so falling backwards. And particularly of note is the, you know, the huge increase in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people who are being held in detention without sentence, and that's really problematic, and it's really harmful for these kids who, you know, are owed the right to be in their communities and go through the court system process. But in all of the states and territories, and most of the states and territories, in fact, Aboriginal kids are being held in detention without being sentenced, which is something that the Human Rights Law Centre and many Aboriginal legal organisations and advocacy organisations have been making a lot of noise about for a really long time, and it's something that needs to change, because putting our babies in those circumstances, those situations, is really harmful for them, and they deserve better.
Maggie, of particular concern, I've just had a look here at the media release, and it appears that the Human Rights Law Centre supports the Commission's calls for the Victorian Government to overhaul its hardline approach to youth crime. And you've talked a little bit about that, haven't you? This is also a federal issue, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's been this really downward kind of spiral, I guess, in the states and territories for a number of years to introduce really harsh, really punitive law and policy that target Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, whether intentionally or not. That's the very real impact that we're seeing. You know, the Victorian kind of tough on crime laws are just a carbon copy of what Queensland passed in 2024. And, you know, we're seeing that kind of shift all across the country, these sort of laws that are really knee-jerk kind of reactions to things, but do nothing to actually support children and their families who are engaging in this kind of behaviour. It's just a quick and easy sort of thing for the governments to do. And, you know, the federal government, the Albanese government, has the ability to sort of intervene and stop these things from happening, and yet are seemingly refusing to. And that's really concerning when governments choose not to act on things that are causing real harm to young, you know, children as young as 10 in some places. These are little kids that we're talking about who are exposed to these systems and often, you know, are trapped in these systems, and we want to change that. And absolutely the report from the Victorian Commission for Children and Young People, you know, made some really strong recommendations, some really strong calls to overhaul the system.
Tell us about those recommendations.
So the report itself is really quite lengthy. It's called
Sure.
With Us, Not Against Us, and it's looking at, I guess, all of the things that we can hear directly from children who have been in the criminal legal system at that young age, and they list a bunch of really strong recommendations. You know, they're certainly not new recommendations. I feel like, you know, children's rights advocates, Aboriginal advocates, for a long time have been calling for, you know, for exactly these things. And some of the recommendations, you know, seem like really common sense things, making sure that children and young people who are impacted and involved and interact with the criminal legal system, that their voices are centred throughout kind of any of the, I guess, solutions to what we're experiencing, that we're looking at things, you know, alternatives to the criminal legal system, alternatives to kind of, you know, carceral sentencing, punitive sentencing, that we're looking at ways for, you know, the interaction between child protection or out-of-home care, the criminal legal system, schooling, all of those sorts of things, that there's kind of a little bit more consistency there, because we know, and it has been, you know, really well documented for a long time, that there is a lot of overlap between kids who are in care and who are in the criminal legal system, or who end up in the criminal legal system. So trying to understand what is causing that kind of overlap, and making sure that, you know, government agencies and care agencies are really supporting kids at the earliest possible point. They're looking for a lot of support and investment in place-based youth hubs. There's not a lot of places for children to go around Victoria when their, you know, home might not be safe, or, you know, they want to engage in activities and things like that. So making sure that there is support for, you know, good activities that children want to be
Sure.
engaged in, that might keep them kind of out of some of the offending behaviour that they're getting captured in the system by. So it's really a whole lot of recommendations. You know, there's quite a few in there.
Sure.
None of them Yeah. are new. It's what we've all been calling for a really long time. You know, they're really common sense based things. But the beauty of this report is that it actually does really centre the voices of the children who have been in the legal system, you know, from an early age, and making sure that, you know,
what matters to them and the impact of these systems and laws and policies on them are really heard. And that's absolutely critical when we're doing this kind of work.
One of the things that is really quite atrocious here is about how deaths in custody have not gone down, and the recommendations of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody have not been upheld. And you've also got little children, haven't you, you know, entrenched in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's the root cause of a lot of what we're experiencing. You know, colonisation never ended. It's an ongoing thing. You know, the stolen generations never really ended. We're just seeing children removed by a different system. We're seeing that kind of colonial intent play out through law and policies in 2026 that, you know, target Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, that make it harder for Aboriginal adults to gain access to bail. You know, we're seeing all of the same colonial tactics play out just in a different way in 2026. And, you know, that's a really hard thing to sit with as an advocate, but it's absolutely essential that we continue to, you know, make noise and fight back against these laws and policies, because our people deserve better. You know, we're still here, we're still fighting, we're tough, we're resilient, and we need to make sure that we continue to be, even in the face of laws and policies that seek to really kind of try and keep us down.
I did want to ask a very brief general question just about the removal of the child placement principle in the Northern Territory after the recent atrocious youth law legislation as a result of what happened to Kumanjai Baby.
Yeah, of course. I'm not best placed to speak about it in great detail because I'm not from that country. There's a lot of really incredible advocacy being done by community and Aboriginal legal services like NAJA up there to really push back against the government passing these laws. And what the CLP government in the Northern Territory are doing is really outrageous. You know, the removal of the child placement principle is really harmful. That's something that, you know, has been informed not just by best practice and evidence, but something that comes from who we are as Aboriginal people is keeping
our families together. What is the child placement principle?
The child placement principle, it was in law that if a child is to be removed from their family, that there's kind of an order, I guess, of where those children are placed. And it kind of follows the kinship care sort of methodology, if you will. And it speaks that an Aboriginal child being removed from their family will be placed with another Aboriginal family member. If that's not possible, then they'll be placed with another Aboriginal family or Aboriginal community. And if that's not possible, only at an absolute last resort will they be placed with a non-Aboriginal carer. And the Northern Territory government's new law has wiped the Aboriginal child placement principle and made it a principle for all children, and really removed the depth of kinship care, of community care from that principle. And noting I'm not from the Territory, of course, but what that means in practice is that there's that sever of cultural tie and that sever of community and kinship that Aboriginal people rely on. And that is especially important culturally, socially, spiritually for our kids to stay grounded with their community and with their people. So for the government to just wipe that is really, it's pretty offensive actually, but it's also really harmful, and it's concerning about what that will do in terms of Aboriginal children being removed and not placed with family or community or other Aboriginal people. So it's really unfair. It's really a kick in the teeth to community up there who have fought for so long for the best practice for our kids and our communities. I think it's really devastating, and you know, my heart goes out to the mob up there who have been trying to make sure that the government doesn't do this, and then to see them do that and fly in the face of, you know, all of the best practice, but also the importance of what Aboriginal people in the Territory know works for them is just, yeah, it's really frustrating.
The Albanese government needs to show national leadership on youth justice. If it doesn't, what could happen, or what is already happening, is that there's assimilation and that funding and budgets are not actually going to be reflecting community-controlled Aboriginal organisations anymore. It's all going to be about mainstream rhetoric.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we're, you know, we're really calling for and have called for a really long time, is that, you know, we need our politicians who have said time and time again that they really care about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities to kind of put their money where their mouth is, you know, and take real tangible steps, you know, to show leadership and to show that, you know, we're not just political kind of gotcha points, but actually that, you know, we are constituents, we are communities that matter, we're people that deserve justice, and the Albanese government really has the power and the ability to sort of step in and stop these things from happening, and yet they don't. So we'll continue making noise alongside, you know, other Aboriginal organisations and community-controlled organisations and advocates who have been doing this work for a really long time and have been leading this fight for ages. We'll continue to walk alongside them and hold the government to account.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was a conversation between Marisa Sposaro of 3CR's Due in Time and Maggie Munn, the Director of First Nations Justice at the Human Rights Law Centre, which was broadcast on the 3rd of August. And Marisa and Maggie were discussing the Productivity Commission's latest Closing the Gap report showing a rise in First Nations young people held in detention without sentence. And they also touched on the report released by the Victorian Commission on Children and Young People and broke down the Northern Territory government's abolishment of key aspects of child placement principles. And you can tune in to Due in Time every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. on 3CR 855 a.m. And now, Inez.
Yes, and now we are joined in the studio by Melinda Davis, who's a Swinburne education expert, joining me to discuss why Victorian teachers are set to strike for the third time this year on Wednesday, the 19th of August. And we outline how we got here, the compounding pressures on the sector and teachers, and where union negotiations are and the demands. Thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Before we dive in, could you tell us a little bit more about the work you do at Swinburne, Melinda?
Yeah, for sure. I am a senior lecturer in education at Swinburne University of Technology, and I teach initial teacher education. So I have the great privilege of teaching the next generation of classroom teachers. But before I came into academia, I was actually a secondary school teacher and deputy principal for 30 years. And so coming into academia now, my focus in research is around women's representation in leadership and but also teaching, yeah, as I said, the next generation of classroom teachers.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Mm. And to see from your secondary school and like previous experience to now working in tertiary education, what do you see as some of like the pressures on the sector from your time before and now?
Yeah, I think that, you know, speaking about this particular issue, you know, I come at it from a place of, you know, I've been in the classroom and I've been in that space for many, many years. And I think that, you know, there are these compounding issues that have led to where we are currently in terms of the industrial action. And I think particularly, you know, since the pandemic, there's been a really, really seismic shift in what we perceive to be teaching and education, not only in Australia, but globally. There's a teacher shortage globally that I'm not sure that everyone also realises happening. And I think that the pandemic really, you know, required teachers, especially as a profession, to shift and to change so much. And then obviously, you know, after the pandemic, you know, say post-2022, there hasn't actually been much of a shift in what we expect of teachers. And it's just been, you know, more and more things that have been sort of layered on, more issues in terms of, you know, compliance. And they're all very good things that we need to do. But there hasn't actually been an adjustment in workload or an acknowledgement of that. And that has ended up being almost like a death of a thousand cuts in a lot of ways. And teachers who have previously done so much amazing work from goodwill are now saying, look, you know, the goodwill's running out.
Yep. And the goodwill is not enough to sustain a profession. And as we're seeing, you know, there's failing staff numbers, workloads. You know, this is the third time that Victorian Teachers have gone on strike, as well as nationwide strikes. And the next action will be on Wednesday, the 19th of August. What has happened the last two strikes this year? Why have the offers simply not been good enough? And what has been the response?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think that, you know, we read a lot in the media about, you know, teachers walking off the job and so on. But I think it's really important to give a bit of an arc around how we have actually come to this place, because earlier this year on the 24th of March, that was the first statewide teacher strike in 13 years. That's a long time. And that included, you know, 35,000 teachers who voluntarily went and you know, walked out for strike action. And after that, obviously, that was the first deal that was rejected. The in-principle agreement was endorsed by the AAU leadership, but however, the members actually rejected it in June by almost 58%, leading to the next rejection of the offer that was made in July, and it was only just marginally rejected. It was about a 51-52%. But what's interesting is that the fact that, you know, this concept of, you know, teachers holding out for better pay, it's not about better pay. It is actually about working conditions. And why they are holding out for that is because the essentially the two or three main issues that teachers are wanting to be addressed, which aren't pay as the number one issue, haven't been addressed by the government, which is why they are holding out and are striking again.
Yeah, it's such an important point as to the sustainability of the profession. Pay is one part of it, and there's so much rhetoric that, like, you should just be grateful for whatever you're getting and just accept it, but that is completely unfair. As you said, it's like the 13 years of the first strike was since then. So, and I'm curious as well, like, as you, since you've been also like a deputy principal, if your staff were also going on industrial action, how is that supported in the organisation?
Yeah, so I think, you know, for your listeners, it's important to know that, you know, there are essentially three different sectors in schooling. So you've got government sectors, you've got private, and also Catholic. So there are actually three different and distinct sectors. And what will happen is that the government system will negotiate through EBAs and in this instance go on strike with industrial action. And that will then filter down or filter across to the agreements that are held by the other sectors. So coming back to the government sector, the principals who are in government schools, my understanding is that they are completely supportive of that. I know my own two children go to a government school, and I was talking to some teachers last week at their school, and their principal also went out on strike action, and that is actually something that we are seeing across representation of the people who are, you know, turning up and protesting, that it isn't just teachers, it's education support staff, who are a huge part of why the teachers have rejected the offer, because they wanted the education support staff to also have better working conditions. But we're also seeing, deputy principals, principals, you know, lots and lots of people in the education community in support of what the teachers are asking for.
Yeah, that's amazing. And particularly with education support staff and holding out to support them, who are the education support staff in schools and universities?
Oh, I think it would be fair to say that the education support staff, as you said, in universities and in schools, are the glue that holds schools together. You know, we've, in the last sort of 5 or 10 years, one of the reasons why that schooling has changed so much, and this is a good thing again, is that we're seeing much more earlier intervention with children who may have particular learning needs. So with the advent of more sort of, you know, research into brain science, There's earlier intervention. Children are being diagnosed with things like ADHD and other you know, kinds of disabilities. And what's really important is that those children are still maintained and included in mainstream schools. However, teachers, classroom teachers, the people that I teach, we can only teach them so much to support students with those particular needs. And so we need education support staff who are specially trained, and they are amazing, amazing people, and contribute so much to classrooms. We need them to work alongside the teaching staff, and they do. However, if funding is cut, and that's one of the foundational issues around this particular industrial strike action, without funding, schools can't afford to pay for those staff. And currently, those staff actually earn significantly less than classroom teaching staff. So there are many, many issues at play, and they're all connected. But education support staff are a phenomenal part of how good teaching can actually be in Victoria, and they deserve to be supported.
That is incredible. Thank you so much for outlining that. And I'm hearing from you that it's really across all sectors and all kinds of schooling, that it's not just one sector or one type of teacher. It's literally the entire system of the schooling. And I know that the Premier Ben Carroll has not met with union officials since being appointed to the top job, despite the political rhetoric that he has been stating about publicly declaring his resolve to end the pay dispute, which is very interesting. What are your thoughts on this, and how do you hope the Premier will be able to support the sustainability of the profession as he has promised?
Yeah, look, I think that obviously this is a political issue as much as it is, you know, a professional issue. And look, to be fair, Premier Carroll has been in the role for only a couple of days at this point. So perhaps he hasn't been able to meet in. But look, I think, you know, it's important to understand too that Premier Carroll has actually been involved in the conversations all the way through. He is the one who has had his offers rejected. So he's very much across the conversation that needs to occur. And I think that the reason this really is becoming much more time sensitive is because of, you know, the compounding looming date of the next election. And I think that what's happened is that the union has very cannily jumped on that and said, we need to meet, let's sort this out. And I do believe that there will be resolution, but we do need to have all parties coming together and finding a way through and coming to solution, which I do believe is possible. And as you said, to cut through the rhetoric and actually come to a new reality.
Absolutely. And from the strike and your demands, at least from tertiary educators and professions, or I guess broadly as well from the strike, what are the demands, or what are you hoping from the negotiations and the strike itself?
Oh, look, I still regard myself as a teacher.
Yeah.
Even though I've moved into a different part of it, I just want the recognition for teachers, whether that is through fair pay, a working wage, but also the acknowledgement of the work that they do, the acknowledgement that this isn't actually strike action that's focused on money. And when you consider that they've rejected this offer, you know, already, they would have, if it was about money, they would have just taken the money and run.
Yeah.
So the reason that it keeps getting rejected is because, you know, the classroom cap sizes haven't been agreed on. That's a huge part of the teacher workload. I would love to see my profession sustainable. Teaching is a wonderful profession. I've done it for 30 years. It's a huge part of who I am. And I want more people to come into teaching. It's so rewarding, but it's also a huge part of creating a society that is able to think independently, to question, to you know, have healthy lives. We know that education is what actually makes a sustainable future, and we need teachers to do that.
Yeah, I think it's so important to really touch on that, with how classroom sizes are getting bigger, parents are having to work more and having to put more demands on the schooling system. It's all is systemic, but it does really funnel down to the people that are seeing the adults and children every single day, and having to be the support, and often in a profession that is largely dominated by women, and kind of exploiting the passion and the passion and support that we see across like nursing and social work, but we don't see that with apprentices and similarly. Anyway, lastly, can you tell us more about the strike, how we can learn more, support and participate?
I think, you know, you asking me to be here and to talk about this is a huge part of that, and I'm so grateful because, you know, if your listeners today hear that this isn't about money. This is actually about working conditions, then that's a big part of how people can be supportive. I would also really love it if people who are listening, you know, spoke to their teachers, you know, when they went and picked up their kids this afternoon or tomorrow morning and said, hey, you know, I really appreciate what you're doing. I can't tell you what it means to a teacher to hear that. Teachers are really, they do their best. They do their best every single day under the most extraordinary circumstances, and there are a lot of schools out there where teachers are doing their very best with very little. And I think understanding the issue from the inside out rather than just listening or believing what the media may say about money and inconveniencing parents is the point, or being inconvenient is the point of strike action. And I think that when we consider again, it was 12 years ago that teachers went out on strike, teachers actually need to be heard. That's what I hope comes from strike action.
And if there are any parents that are listening right now that are driving their kids to school, hi kids, what would you like, would you like them to know about the action and maybe what they might be able to say to their teachers?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point too. You know, we can't sort of take away the fact that the students are involved in this. They're wondering why their teachers aren't there and asking those questions. And I think the conversation that parents can have, you know, with their children is that this is about equity. This is about fairness. It's about recognising work. It's about understanding the role of education in our society, our culture, and valuing that. We value education and we value learning. And these are the foundations and cornerstone of a thriving society. So I think, you know, being respectful to teachers, understanding that they have an enormous amount that they do, a lot of it's unpaid, unseen, and just valuing them will go a long way.
Absolutely. And for any teachers that are listening to this right now, we just wanted to tell you at 3CR that we really value you. And anybody that is interested in participating in the strike, we will have all the information on how to do that on Wednesday, the 19th of August. Thank you so much, Melinda, for coming on the show.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you just heard Melinda Davis and I from Swinburne join us to discuss why Victorian teachers are set to strike for the third time this year on Wednesday, the 19th of August. You're listening to 3CR at 8:55 a.m.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from SoCalled Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 a.m. or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman, with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
...3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. Hello, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is just coming up to 7:46 in the morning, and we're heading into our next interview with Idil and Ilo from the Centre Against Racial Profiling, who join us for a conversation about the upcoming launch of The People's Record, a podcast about race, policing, and public housing in NARM, Melbourne. This incredible series tells the story of the public housing towers, the flats, in NARM, focusing on the vitality and resistance of the community in the face of racialized policing and structural violence. This Saturday, the 8th of August, The People's Record will be launched at IPCS, where the sixth and final episode of the show will be recorded live. And The People's Record will be broadcasting daily on 3CR 855 AM from the 8th of August. Good morning, Idil and Ilo.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. It is so exciting to see that this project is finally going to be out in the world. And I really love the snippets that have been shared from the interviews that you've done as part of this series across Instagram for the past week or so. But I wanted to take us back to the start about the impetus for the podcast itself. So maybe, Idil, starting with you, why talk about race policing and public housing together? Why now?
I would say because they exist together. They can't exist separately. For the answer of why now, I noticed that what's happening with public housing right now is something that's consistently been happening. So we know that the announcement made about the privatization of public housing, whatever, which way the government wants to speak about it, but we know that it's privatization by another name. And it's the ongoing attack on public housing. We saw what happened during hard lockdown, but before that and during that and consistently, specifically in this community, when I think about North Melbourne, Carlton, Flemington, Kensington, is the policing, the othering, the deciding who's disposable and who's not, and it being race-based.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is a lot of African communities that are, you know, from a lot of different countries, people from refugee backgrounds, people who have intergenerational relationships to these buildings, right, that are across those communities.
Yeah, absolutely. Predominantly East African Muslim community that lived in Gov housing, specifically in the inner city, yeah.
Yeah, and Ilo, what about you? How have you seen these kind of issues come together as something that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I think
I think that the policing, like when you talk racial profiling in Melbourne, you necessarily have to speak about the flats. And I think that's exactly why this podcast kind of brings those two together. When we started the project, we were actually thinking of making a very kind of procedural podcast about racial profiling and just that. And we soon realized that we couldn't do that without introducing the flats as a character, without trying to explain what they mean, where they sit in the context of Melbourne and its landscape. And so it was necessary for us to actually make a podcast about the flats and racial profiling, because they are linked very deeply. That's not to say that racial profiling doesn't happen in every other aspect of life and around Melbourne, but it really concentrates and it has a history in these public housing pockets, especially in the inner city. And so that was kind of necessary. And the why now is, I mean, yeah, it's been happening for ages and it continues to happen. But now with the destruction of those flats, with the moving on of those communities, it's another form of racial profiling. It's another form of policing, but that's just much more current and with a different name.
Yeah, and I mean, I think about, you know, the scrutiny and targeting of public housing and the scrutiny and targeting of racialized folks in the community. And as you've both said, that story can't be told without talking about the flats. It's different arenas, I guess, of profiling, but that sort of overlap in this space. But also, it is a space where there have been such incredible ongoing efforts of resistance and community building and expressions of solidarity. And I think that's a beautiful thing that this podcast also kind of surfaces, is the texture of people's lives in the flats, and really going into the nuance of those kinds of conversations. I did want to ask, though, Ilo, about the relationship. You know, when people think about racial profiling and the flats, for those who have any sort of memory of media over the past 10, 15 years, they will think of the Hail Michael case and of Daniel Hail Michael. Can you remind us about what happened there and the relationship of that case to this show?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that was central to the story we were telling at the beginning. Really, it was a reminder of a telling of the story of the case of those boys that were racially profiled in the flats in the mid-2000s, about the campaign of terror that they called it, and the way that the police had systematically targeted black young boys from the flats with their Operation Malto, which was uncovered with the case. And so, you know, that story of these young boys coming together, saying enough, enough, and taking the police to court on racial profiling, Australia's first, with the help of a very tiny little community legal centre, the Flemington Kensington Community Legal Centre, is vital, and it's such an important part of that story. But and the settlement that came out of it was you know, really groundbreaking for its time. And it was, you know, the really impetus for the whole podcast was to ask, what's changed? You know, it's been now 12, 13 years since that settlement. The outcome of all that work that those boys did, and it's been 10 years now, so what's changed? And so this podcast was trying to look at that at the beginning, and I think it's done a little bit of that work, but I think it's much broader than that. It's actually it's an ode to those boys, but also to the whole community that lives there and puts up with that.
Mm. And Idil, I wanted to turn to you on that and ask you about the process of telling the story, because as Ilo has mentioned, you know, the kind of story that you wanted to tell has morphed from the initial pitch that you might have made about the podcast. What was it like to, you know, go through that process of decision making and say, how do we want to talk about the flats?
Yeah, I think it's always difficult when you're telling a story that belongs to so many people. It's a story of a whole community, and I think we've only captured a portion of it. There's so much stories to be told about our community's resistance and the way that we have responded to this ongoing treatment, you know. And I think
We did it through a series of interviews. We really wanted to capture what was happening at that time with the Hail Michael case, but also what's happened since then and what the experiences of policing is currently for young people. We really wanted to be conscientious of, like, not making people relive really traumatic experiences, but instead really focusing in on what is it the story that our community has been trying to tell this whole time about our experience, but how we resist as well. We interviewed a lot of different people that were involved, that still remain involved. And I think the thing that stood out to me is that our community, we do have a very strong network of support that we do continue to resist. And it's an ongoing story. It's not one that's ended. And I think the privatizing of gov housing, I think, is an attempt to end a story, but not the conditions. You know, racial profiling is still happening. And like Ilo said, it happens everywhere and throughout Victoria. But public housing is one of the sites of resistance. And it's a way our community has been able to be to support each other. And we see so many examples of that. And I think our dispersion is an attempt to stop our resistance. So I think the process has been, for me, I think I've learned a lot. And I think it's a space that we're continuing to learn and hoping to continue to have these conversations. But I think really careful to not stick to conversations. Really, it's a place of action. And it's great to be interviewing all the people that we did interview, because they're all really active in their lives, all the things that they're doing. It's been great to bring that together and to have an opportunity to collectively remember resistance. I think that's something that happens with movement, is that we keep moving and we're on to the next. So creating a bit of space for reflection has been really helpful.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you both, maybe Idil first and then Ilo, how has making the podcast changed you? What impact has it had on you to go through this process of trying to tell some of the story?
Yeah, I think working with Ilo and Lucy, I think the thing that stood out to me was I felt very much that I benefited from movement that happened specifically in our community when I was a teenager and before being as involved in it, just being a person within my community. You know, you start to do things, you start to protest and you start to be involved in things. And then you realize, hey, actually, all these people know each other. There's a real strong network of people who've been doing this work and you don't notice until you join the work. And I think for me, the change that it did for me really reinforced something that I knew, and I feel like I got an opportunity to really pay respect to people who built some really strong foundations. So I think in terms of how it changed me, I think it really reinforced something that I've been discovering over a period of time, and it's given me immense gratitude for my community, which I think that I've been shouting from the rooftops for all of my life. But I think now I get to say, hey, here you go. To my own community and to everyone else, just so you know, this is what we've been saying. Like, we're community built, you know, we're community bred. And this doesn't come from nowhere.
Yeah.
This really strong voice that I hope that I can be is really coming from, it's really nurtured somewhere and really cared for.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Ilo?
I kind of thought that. That's amazing. I think the podcast, working on the podcast, you know, it's a project that I've never done. Like, I'm not a creative, I'm not an artist, I'm not those things. And coming into a space of, you know, the initial idea was to turn a report that we had done into a spoken piece of audio to be able to get more reach. And so then it turning into this amazing, sprawling conversation with some amazing people, Sharon Dusting, Ricky Onus, with Crystal McKinnon, with some of the voice on the flats, Daniel Hamark, like all these amazing voices, and then kind of weave it all together with the magic of Idil and Lucy and our the person who's made the music, Pip, and all these amazing people. That's something that has changed me. I think this kind of creativity, this spark of work, and listening to the stories and weaving them together and saying, hey, there's something here that's much more than just telling of facts. It's it's like an ode, it's like a poem, it's like a piece of art that can do so many more things than what dry report can do. And I think that's something I've taken with me for other projects.
That is, I mean, it is amazing. And I'm just so excited to hear how it's all come together. And I guess just to wrap up, if either of you want to speak to this very briefly, what's in store for the launch event at IPCS on Saturday?
You go for it, Idle.
We're going to play a bit of the podcast. We're going to all get together. We're going to have some really great Somali catering. We're going to have to squish in because we know a bunch of people are coming, more than who've gotten tickets. So very typical community manner. We're going to be having a great chat, a great time, and great eats. I think one of the things that we're really interested in is exploring archiving and thinking about archiving as a form of resistance. And I think a lot of folk who are in movement have phenomenal stories to tell that we can really benefit from. And as part of that, also, the people doing movement are dealing with the systems of oppression that we're pushing against. So it's really hard to have a moment to pause and actually record these stories, and also the considerations around surveillance, the considerations around people and the careers they're in and the lives that they're living and the trauma that they've been through. Who wants to record the stories? Mm-hmm. For what purpose? How will it be used? There's all these considerations to make. So I think really wanting to create some space to have discussions about that and encouraging us documenting whether or not we share publicly or we keep privately, that we share with a few or with the masses, like really having a think about how we do these things and how do we keep our movement stories alive, and that we don't allow co-optation to happen within our communities, to be strong in our messaging and refined and to continue to build consensus within our communities, right? So really interested to just have a space to be together. And really, it's funny because we're at the end of the podcast, you know, like we've done all the recordings, so we keep feeling like, well, it's done, but I think it's the beginning for so many other people. So I keep being like, oh, so this is the final episode, and people are like, we haven't heard it yet.
I was just gonna say, I think this is gonna be actually just opening up to the next thing, right? And I can imagine that, you know, You're only talking about part of the story. You're talking about a couple of points in time. And by bringing everybody together on Saturday, I have a sneaking suspicion that 2 hours may not be enough to begin opening up those conversations, because this could turn into, you know, this could go in 1,000 different directions of people, you know, deciding on how to share their stories and keep building a community-determined archive that really captures the flats and life in the flats for, you know, generations to come. So I just want to thank you both so much for making the time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us. And what a stunning lineup that you have. Been listening. I'm excited to keep listening.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to seeing you both on Saturday.
See you there.
Bye. And that was Idil and Illo from the Center Against Racial Profiling talking about the upcoming launch of The People's Record, a podcast about race, policing and public housing in Melbourne. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast and it is 8:02 in the morning.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the sporting record.
or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
Hello, you're listening to 3CR 855 AM, and we are now joined by Nick Seaton, the CEO of Parents for Climate, a national parent advocacy organisation working to empower communities to make the climate safer for children. Now, today, Nick joins us to talk about the Parent for Climate's push to close the Climate Active program. Thank you so much for being on the show, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
So, formerly known as the National Carbon Offset Standard, which even the rebranding of the program is interesting, it's now known as the Climate Active Certification Program. I was wondering if you could give us a breakdown on what this is.
So, for a long time, Climate Active has been operating as a certification scheme. So, basically giving certificates or special brands for companies to use in their marketing and to display to show that they were supporting some form of climate action, which was questionable because it was all based on the use of offsets by purchasing carbon credits. And some of the markets and some of the standards of these carbon credits was extremely low and the value of them extremely questionable. So the whole system has operated for quite some time, and hundreds and hundreds of companies in Australia have participated in this system voluntarily. But in, you know, the worst case scenario, you could describe it as a form of state-sponsored greenwashing, because unfortunately we were giving out, or the federal government was giving out, these lovely logos saying that these companies were carbon neutral without actually having to prove that that was the case.
Mm. And I understand that Parents for Climate has been, you know, holding a sustained investigation into, you know, sort of greenwashing for years now, and released a report that sort of scrutinised 34 companies regarding their claims. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you found through this report.
Yeah, certainly. So a lot of these companies, the listeners will know, the retailers that we rely on for purchasing energy, whether that's electricity or gas, for our homes and small businesses. And we found that of all of the retailers, about one in three, or about a third of them, were at risk of essentially greenwashing, which is a word to describe when a company makes a claim about their products or their operations that they are more green or better for the environment or the climate than they really are. And in Australian consumer law, it's often described as misleading and deceptive conduct, where someone's being falsely sort of led to believe one thing when in reality there's something else going on. And in the case of electricity and gas, that often means that people are being told that that gas and electricity might be carbon neutral, which sounds really good because it sounds like there's nothing to worry about. But actually, as our activities have shown, we can't undo the harms of burning coal and gas for the production of energy just by using offsets.
Yeah, and I guess based around concerns of, you know, this greenwashing and perhaps taking advantage of a state-sponsored program of greenwashing, as you put it earlier, Parents for Climate have been campaigning for years to close the Climate Active program. The government has recently announced that it plans on closing the program. However, it has floated the option of keeping some voluntary standards and select guidance, and is currently undertaking consultation around whether or not it should do this. So I'm just wondering, Parents for Climate believe that they should keep some voluntary standards? Should they do so?
Look, in our view, yes. We think the government has a role to play here to make sure that standards are of high integrity and that they're being operated and maintained by the government. Otherwise, we're worried what could happen where companies might decide to sort of make their own standards, go their own way, or start to participate in other private systems or other international systems that are really dubious or low quality. So essentially, at the end of the day, we just need less pollution in the atmosphere that's driving, you know, global warming and making costs go up and really undermining our economy and our natural ecosystem.
Mm. And when you say standards of integrity, what might these look like?
Well, that's right. We need to make sure that what people are doing to reduce pollution is actually true, and that it actually works. And in a lot of cases, the carbon credits and the offsets that companies have been using have been shown to not help, not make a difference, or not be clear enough that we can be sure that they're making a difference. And that's not good enough. So we need to know that there are standards in place, that if companies are claiming to do something good or are buying offsets or carbon credits and using that as a marketing tool, then we need to know that they're telling the truth. And so those standards are still quite important, even if it is a good idea that climate activism is retired. It's high time that we close that greenwashing loophole. But rather than drop it entirely and walk away from the field, we'd like to see the federal government stay in the conversation and play a role of setting a high standard.
Mm. And new mandatory climate disclosure requirements have been introduced by the Australian government under the Australian Sustainability Reporting Standard. These are being phased in now and over the next 2 years and require financial disclosures on climate-related risks and opportunities for companies throughout their governance, strategy, risk management and climate targets. What are Parents for Climate's thoughts on these mandatory requirements, and do you believe they'll be effective in preventing greenwashing by companies?
So it's a great thing that big companies are having to measure and monitor and report on their pollution or where there's pollution in their supply chain. That's fantastic. So we're very in favour of that. I think what we also need to say, though, is that it's one thing to measure it, it's another thing to do something about it. And so we also want to see there to be more incentives and more support for companies to actually get on and reduce that pollution. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily going to happen just because we're measuring it. And while you need to measure what you want to manage, we want to make sure that there are, you know, genuine pathways to reducing that pollution. And unfortunately, that's not immediately obvious. So while I'd say it's very effective at managing, but not very effective at mitigating the pollution. Mm.
So we need more action-based action rather than claims-based action.
Exactly, yeah. We want to know that you know, companies are actually getting through it. Like, this is a job we have to do. It's going to, you know, take some time, and that's understandable. But at the end of the day, if we don't remove pollution from supply chains and from production, then that has a cost. Mm. And that cost might not be being paid by the company. It might be being paid by mums and dads who are watching their bills go up or their insurance premiums go up or, you know, worrying about the next flood or fire or drought. These are problems that we need to work on as a society, and that's what the federal government's role is all about.
Hmm. And to wrap up, Nick, if any parents or listeners were interested in learning more about the voluntary and mandatory disclosure requirements or participating in the consultation process for the Climate Active program, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, so if you want to learn a little bit about the background, head over to our webpage, parentsforclimate.org. But you can participate in this consultation there. The government wants to know whether to replace Climate Active with standards and what kind of standards. And that's open until late September, about September 18th. So it's open to everybody, public consultation, and I highly recommend everyone has their say.
Amazing, Nick. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
You too. Thank you very much.
And that was Nick Seaton, CEO of Parents for Climate, speaking about the recent announcement to close the Climate Active program and speaking about Parent for Climate's concerns around greenwashing through the program.
Into the Fold explores what happens when disabled people in the media get together to devise and run our own professional development infrastructure, building community, getting stuck into the nuts and bolts of the training and broadcast sectors, and how we entwine radio careers in the course of our lives. Plus, you'll get to discover your new favourite tunes from performers and composers who are living with disability while honing their craft across the idioms of sensual R&B, vibrant jazz, frothy country pop, and more. Catch Into the Fold here on 3CR from the 17th of August. Monday mornings at 10:30.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:14 in the morning and we are coming up to our final interview for today. And we are joined now by Bill McKenzie, Deputy Chair of the 44 Flats United Layfield Court Residents Committee, who is speaking with us to recap yesterday's action where elderly high-rise public housing residents took their petition to resist the demolition of their homes to the office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos. The Layfield Court Residents Committee represents residents at 150 Victoria Avenue, Albert Park, an older person's high-rise where Bill has lived for 16 years. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Priya and listeners.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I just wanted to begin by grounding this conversation in how you got involved in the fight to save your housing and public housing. Where do you live and what does public housing mean to you?
Well, at 150 Victoria Avenue, Albert Park, which was built in 1967. I've been here actually about 19 years, and it's 55 and overs. And in my case, and a lot of other people here, it's changed our lives and picked us up from living in social isolation and other issues associated with homelessness, etc. The fight sort of began here when the actual demolitions were announced a couple of years ago, but when the Victorian government announced on the 29th of January this year, that the over 55s were to be demolished next. That came as a shock to us all, and that's when many of us became involved in the fight to protect our homes.
And I understand, previous communications after that initial announcement seem to suggest that the over 55s towers, there's 13 across Melbourne and 7 were announced at the start of this year, that they would be left till later in the program. So it did come as quite a shock to people living in those towers and also to, advocates supporting them. And I know that there has been a lot of organizing going on now in these high rises, especially across the over 55 high rises, and that I don't want to say culminated because the fight is ongoing, but one of the big moments was yesterday's action, where there was a lot of folks across at least four different estates that took your petitions to resist the demolition of your homes to the office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos, who I should note is also the Minister for Building and Precincts, the Minister for Homelessness, and the Minister for Seniors. So it seems like there's a lot that's relevant in his portfolio here. You were part of the delegation that went inside One Spring Street to deliver the petitions. What was that like?
There were eight of us, two delegates from Layfield Court in Albert Park, Inkerman Heights in St Kilda, and delegates from Kensington and Flemington Towers. The minister wasn't there, but we did actually spend an hour with his chief of staff, housing advisor, and two Homes Victoria people. Now, we understand that the minister was in the building and was, in fact, being interviewed by Channel 9 around that time. But we actually did get to spend an hour in discussion. and sometimes fairly emotional discussion with the minister's chief of staff and his housing advisor and those Victoria people, and pushed the point fairly heavily that there's a lot of opposition to the demolition and the actual process. I think one of the things we were trying to get across yesterday is that because of the timing and the sudden timing, the whole population of the old person's towers are in, it's just in chaos and is impacting really adversely upon people's well-being and health, just with the dysfunctional way the Homes Victoria has handled the entire process.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, it is, well, it's very interesting to know that the minister was in the building and was doing his own media at the time that you came in with the delegation to present your petition and present your very real, very felt, lived concerns of the impacts of this policy decision. But yeah, what were some of the main things that you mentioned in your letter to the minister, which I should also note, there was a bit of lead time, you know, to prepare the minister and his team to understand that you were going to take this action.
Yeah, it's been the letter to the minister. Actually, I think the main point of it puts across that this was our home for a long time, and was a really a place that we had found ourselves and was a successful thing. And I think the fact that the government has not been able to provide proper reasons for the demolition, we've never seen this steel material being withheld from us, confidential cabinet and that sort of thing, and the actual lack of proper and a proper explanation of why the buildings are technically in need of demolition, and just the whole the fact that you had something that was really working and you've just torn the heart out of it. And that's been sort of, I think, what we collectively were trying to get across to the minister.
Well, I mean, you've put it so powerfully just then. I'm really hoping that the minister's chief of staff and the Homes Victoria staff that were there really heard that message. I wanted to ask, you know, more broadly, what yesterday felt like and what it's been like to connect with people across the over 55s high rises who are also pushing back against the government's demolition plans.
Yes, it was a fairly cold and rainy morning outside number one Spring Street. And to just the people that did get there, that was a pretty good turnout. Yeah, for such a morning, we had to sort of like some of our people that would have come, but for health reasons, it was decided to keep everybody, keep some people away. But I think the fact that people, I left there with a sense of unity and a sense of comradeship with many people who I'm only just meeting from the other towers, and a feeling of unification, and that we are starting to get momentum in the lead up to the state election, and collectively, again, I use that word, will probably make a difference and an impact upon the elections. The fact that they gave us about an hour, the eight delegates, that was at least one I'd say, good point in that we're able to put some things across so they know there's an issue. But I think it's sort of, I left there with a feeling, as did some other people I was talking to, that the fight's really only starting to begin, even though it's been, but we're becoming more organised, and I think the options open to us in the future are going to be, will have an impact, at least in attempting to save the towers.
Yeah, I mean, that's really heartening to hear, and I can imagine that it is powerful as well to be in a space with a lot of other people who are experiencing the same thing as you, but also, you know, have all shown up with a commitment to stand firm and to make sure that the government hears your concerns and really takes them seriously. And so just to wrap up, Bill, what's next for, you know, the 44FU Residents Committee at Layfield Court, for yourself in this fight, you know, for people across the older persons high rises?
I think what we do over the next couple of days is sort of probably start preparing for a spring offensive again, and start looking at, we've got a number of eyes in the fire at the moment with plans for the next few months, and it's a matter of just, I think, getting organising with the other towers on a more collective basis, and looking at the other things that you've got. We've still got the High Court decision to come and other possible legal actions. The Ombudsman Inquiry, and there's at least one associated complaint with IBAC at the moment.
Mm.
So, it's a matter of just organising and continuing the fight.
Yeah, wonderful. And look, Bill, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us this morning. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners before we finish up?
I'd just like to just urge everybody to keep on listening to 3CR and supporting 3CR on your, it's an anniversary for you guys, and thank you for your support that you've been giving us.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill. That really does mean a lot, and it's been a privilege to be able to cover the organising that you've been doing, and we look forward to hopefully having you and other 44FU folks on the show in the future.
Thanks very much, Claire.
Thank you. And that was Bill McKenzie, Deputy Chair of the 44FU Layfield Court Residents Committee, who joined us to recap yesterday's action, where folks from the older persons' high-rise flats took their petition to resist the demolition of their homes to the office of Housing Minister Nick Stakos. And as Bill just mentioned, while they did get the opportunity to meet with the Chief of Staff of Stakos and with some Homes Victoria staff, Stakos was in the building at the time, but did not meet with the residents directly, but I believe did do a bit of media with Channel 9. So we are coming up to the end of our program for today. We'll do a quick recap of what we covered. First up, you heard from Marissa Spasaro of 3CR's Do In Time, who spoke with Maggie Munn, a Gungari advocate and director of First Nations Justice at Human Rights Law Centre, to talk about the failure of state and federal governments in the incarceration of First Nations young people being held without a sentence.
And then we were joined by Melinda Davies, who's a Swinburne education expert, who joined us to discuss the Victorian teachers are set to strike for the third time this year on Wednesday, the 19th of August, and really spoke about it through all sectors. Please join.
And after that, we heard from Idil and Illo from the Centre Against Racial Profiling to talk about the upcoming launch of The People's Record, a podcast about race, policing and public housing in NARM, Melbourne.
Following that, we spoke with Nick Seaton, CEO of Parents for Climate, about their push to close the Climate Active program that they argue is based on,
a bit of greenwashing. And finally, as you just heard, we were joined by Bill McKenzie, Deputy Chair of the 44 Flats United Layfield Court Residents Committee, and he recapped yesterday's action and spoke about I think really inspiringly what that kind of coalition building across the older person's high rises, but across the flats in general, has meant, and how it provides a foundation for the struggle to continue into the future. And a reminder again that it is Homeless Persons Week or Homelessness Week, and we encourage folks to follow the work of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, who will be launching their new program soon on 3CR called Tuned In, Locked Out. So to find out more, to donate to their efforts, you can head to Homeless Persons Union Vic on Instagram. That's all we've got time for on today's show, but we look forward to catching up with you again next week. Please stay tuned for Lost in Science. Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.